Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, Cambridge police say they'll launch an internal review of the controversial forceful arrest this weekend of a Harvard University student. We'll have the latest. Also today, cold, wet, and still crushing it. Boston Marathon runners brave the nasty weather.
On a day like today, exposure and hypothermia are probably going to be the bigger factors to address.
Plus, how a marathon bombing survivor is slowly reclaiming her love of race day.
It's clearly not my favorite day anymore. I do work hard at making it, try to have it become that again.
And why one former marathon winner walks across the finish line now.
And then I just crossed the marathon at a very casual stroll, just overwhelmingly happy that I'm out there.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Every year, I admire the intrepid souls who run the Boston Marathon, but this year, I am in absolute awe because race conditions, quite frankly, could not be worse. I suppose the only way they could be worse is if it were snowing, but we've had pouring rain, gusting winds, and the cold. But folks are still finishing strong, even if their finishing times aren't breaking any records. Men's push-rim wheelchair, women's push-rim wheelchair, and the elite men and women runners all posted the slowest winning times in over 30 years. Well, WBUR's Alex Ashlock has had a front row seat for the men's and women's top finishers, and he joins us now. Hi there, Alex.
Hey, Meghna. I could swear it was snowing during part of the race today. It sure felt like it.
Is it dry where you are now, at least?
Well, I'm inside the hotel now. I think it might take me till the 123rd Boston Marathon to dry out next April. But it was just horrible out there, and it still is. People are still finishing. Cold, gusty winds. The rain was just driving across the race course. Some of the runners said the wind was so bad, it nearly stopped them in their tracks today. It was by far the worst weather conditions I've ever seen in my 20 years covering this race.
All right. So did that keep away the crowds? And more importantly, what impact did it have on the runners?
You know, it did slow them down. As you mentioned, the slow times, the rain just, you know, kept them from really going as fast as they might have wanted to today. They were also dressed in many layers of clothing, so that slowed them down as well. But the crowds were huge, Meghna. You would think that who would want to stand out in pelting rain during a day like this, but they were out there. The crowds in the city centers were big, like Natick, Wellesley, and downtown here when Des Linden was finishing the race today, winning for the women. The crowds were huge, as they always are. People had umbrellas, of course. Out further along the course, people set up tents. But the crowds were huge, just like they always are.
Yeah, so I suppose that the runners themselves layered up in order to keep warm, but not much you can do to stay dry, though, in this weather.
No. I mean, yeah, the bottom line is, you know, it didn't really matter. You could have 10 layers on.
Yeah.
I mean, there was just no way you weren't gonna get wet.
All right, the sky's opening up, though. Okay, so you mentioned Des Linden. That's Desiree Linden, the first American woman to win the Boston Marathon since 1985. Tell us about her race.
She felt like dropping out many times in the race, she said today. She just didn't feel well, and it wasn't going well, and she just didn't have high hopes. But then she just kept picking off runners as she continued along the course, and she got up to fourth or third. She wasn't even sure what place she was in. And she said, I can't drop out now. I'm still in the race. So she just hammered down to the finish. And, you know, she finished second here in 2011 and got beaten on Boylston Street, lost by 2 seconds. She said, I didn't want that to happen again. So she said, I never looked back. And she was celebrating as she crossed the finish line. It's a great win for her. It just shows you, you know, she first ran the Boston Marathon, I think, back in 2007. She just hung in there and she persevered And now she has a Boston Marathon championship.
What a win. Now, there's some video showing a moment where her teammate, a very, very highly respected American runner, Shalane Flanagan, she had to take a pit stop during the race. And there's a video showing Desiree Linden slowing down to wait for her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. She talked about that after the race as well, and it didn't surprise me. That didn't surprise me either because, you know, these guys are teammates. These girls, these women are teammates. You know, they're on the American team that was running here today, and they help each other out. The marathon is a long way to run, and there's a lot of bad patches when you're running a marathon, and everybody goes through it. And Linden slowed down to try to help Flanagan. I saw this happen in the Olympic trials a couple of years ago when Flanagan was struggling in the heat in Los Angeles. Her teammate Amy Craig stayed with her as long as she could, tried to help her, encourage her, and they both ended up making the Olympic team. So it's an individual sport, but the runners help each other out, especially on a horrible day like today.
So tell us then about the race on the men's side. A Japanese winner.
Yeah, for the first time since 1987, Yuki Kawauchi passed last year's champion Jeffrey Kiryu very late in the race and won, made some history for Japan. By the way, he said he was born in 1987, which was the last year a Japanese runner won the Boston Marathon. This guy runs, I think he ran something like a dozen marathons last year, so he runs a lot more marathons than most world-class runners do. I'm looking forward to watching his career over the next couple of years because the 2020 Olympics are in Tokyo, and I'm sure Japan is going to have a strong team there, and he might be one of the athletes on that team.
I'm seeing he posted roughly a 2 hours and 15 minutes time, something like that, even in this weather.
Yeah, that's an incredible time. And really, if I'm remembering correctly, at the halfway point, the lead runners were really on pace to run about 2:10 or 2:11. So even though the fact that he ran 2:15 is just incredible given the conditions. Yeah. I think the winning time last year was something like 2:09.
Wow.
So like you said at the beginning, I'm in awe of what these people did today. I just can't emphasize enough how horrible the running conditions were.
Just really quickly, Alex, one last thing. It seems like it was a very strong year for American runners, right? I'm seeing here that 7 of the top 10 women finishers were American and 6 of the top 10 men.
Yeah, I'm just sort of processing that as well. That probably hasn't happened in many, many years. I think we've just seen, and it's been over the last 10 years or so, just a huge American resurgence distance running, and it's played out here at the Boston Marathon. It's just been great to see.
Well, that's WBUR's Alex Ashlock, rain-soaked but happy, bringing us the race results of the elite finish.
Happy to be inside.
Thanks so much, Alex.
You're welcome, Magna.
Well, with all of these cold temperatures and the driving wind and rain, race officials were well prepared, I should say, for the challenge of keeping runners warm and safe, including at the medical tents along the course. Here's Aaron Bagish, Marathon Medical Director.
The inside of the tents, even that are not heated mechanically, end up being warm just due to body heat. So the runners will have warm places all along the course to find shelter should they need it.
And fortunately, the medical support team has kept pace with this year's unique demands, according to Dr. Pierre Demicourt, co-medical chair of the Boston Marathon.
We've had very few critical things up to this point, but we've had a lot of cold runners coming in shivering, and it's a different job this year because we've really got to figure out how to get them warm.
Well, WBUR's Martha Biebinger is inside the medical tent at the marathon finish line, and she's with us now. Hi there, Martha.
Hey, Meghna.
So a little earlier today, you tweeted that the medical tent there was almost full about halfway through the race day. What have you been seeing?
Yes, it's been full pretty steadily. They have expanded the number of cots into areas where they hope to just have some seating room for people, but it's very busy. People running in and out with ambulances and lots of people swaddled in Mylar blankets trying to warm up.
But everything seems to be under control. I mean, in terms of the medical personnel, they're able to handle the needs?
Yes, they have not seen anything life-threatening so far. There is concern that things might get worse in the next few hours. Meghna, as you can imagine, the people who are coming in now have been out in those miserable conditions that Alex was describing for longer. You know, it's taking them a little while to finish the race, and so the body temperature is going to drop a little bit more, and it's still quite windy and rainy out here. And so they're not sure that they've seen the worst of it yet.
Yeah. Well, you talked to one runner who said that he actually saw quite a bit of I don't know how to describe it. A lot of suffering bodies out there on the course.
Yes. He saw people dropping out, and that is supported by the fact that we're seeing higher volumes in the hospitals along the course route. Uh-huh. So at Metro West and Newton Wellesley, they're having higher emergency room volumes today than some of the hospitals at the finish line. And we're also seeing a lot of volume in the tents. They've treated coming up on 900 people in the 22 tents it is along the course. Not quite 1,000 here in the tents downtown yet, but that's a pretty high volume for Marathon Day. Magna, so far about 50 transports to hospitals in total. But again, nothing that we think is life-threatening.
Yeah. Well, that's WBUR's Martha Biebinger reporting to us from the medical tent at the finish line of the Boston Marathon. Martha, thank you so much.
Thank you, Magna.
Well, you know, we've been talking a lot about the weather because that is one of the stories of the marathon today. But for every runner in today's race, just qualifying for the race is a triumph. And it's a trial in and of itself. For one competitor, that journey has been particularly harrowing. His name is Dennis Rainier, and he was 10 miles into the Grand Valley Marathon when something struck the top of his head and nearly knocked him over. He staggered for a few steps, then
put my hand immediately to my head, and it was just like in the cartoons where you see a guy get a big goose egg on his head when he gets bonked.
Well, WBUR sports and society reporter Shira Springer picks up the story from there.
Dennis's head started throbbing, his ears ringing, and his vision blurring. But he looked at his hand and didn't see any blood. So he kept running and thinking,
what's wrong here? Am I like running in mud? Why can't I move? This is not going the way my training has been going.
It was 1978, right in the middle of the running boom, and it was Dennis's fourth marathon. He was in the best shape of his life, and he was confident he would run a personal best at Grand Valley, even though it was unseasonably warm for November in Michigan. But after he was hit, that confidence quickly disappeared.
I was losing about 15, 20 seconds a mile, and I was getting frustrated. Further on I got, the more wobbly I got. I had a little trouble focusing my eyes. And again, I was trying to rationalize what in the world happened here.
Was some kid throwing rocks at runners around mile 10? Could he have been hit by a branch he didn't see? A brick? Finally, Dennis convinced himself it had to be dehydration. He downed Gatorade and defizzed Coca-Cola and dumped water on his head. Nothing helped. He pushed through the pain and the wobbliness as best he could. More than anything, Dennis wanted to finish in 3 hours or better. That would qualify him for the Boston Marathon.
I don't think I'm unique in that drive. And anyone who mentioned the word marathon, the next word would be Boston. Did you go? Have you gone? Can you go? That, I really had no goals beyond that at that point. Just wanted to go to Boston and earn it.
That's why he decided to run the Grand Valley Marathon in the first place. It was a couple hours away from his home in Midland, Michigan, where he lived with his wife, Linda, and worked as a chemist for the Dow Corning Corporation. Grand Valley was a small race, about 300 runners, and the course covered mostly flat, rural roads. At the time, Dennis was 26, and his wife, Linda, was 4 months pregnant with the couple's first child. Linda was waiting for Dennis at the finish just outside Grand Rapids, and she would be waiting for much longer than she expected. Dennis slowed to a walk around the 20-mile mark.
It was only to see if it would clear my head and give me some better focus, but never did the thought occur to me, well, I better sit or quit or take a ride or bail. It never even occurred to me, actually.
And why was that? Why didn't that occur to you?
Well, it's either stupidity or dedication. You can take your pick. Probably stupidity more than anything.
If he'd known then why he was slowing down, Dennis would have dropped out of the race. But all he knew was that walking only made the pain and the dizziness worse. So he started running again. He summoned enough energy to finish strong. He crossed the line with both hands in the air. His time was 3 hours and 9 minutes. Not good enough for Boston. His wife walked over to him.
As she approached me, she had her hands up and was clapping and then immediately said, I thought you were going to break 3 hours. What happened? I said, I don't know. I feel terrible. I think somebody hit me with a brick.
Dennis pointed to the goose egg on the top of his head. Linda told Dennis to get it checked out by the race doctor, but Dennis was in no rush to get medical attention. he'd failed to qualify for Boston. He was disappointed and hungry. Dennis grabbed a hot dog from the post-race food tent. Then he started thinking about trying to qualify for Boston again. Eventually, he made his way to the race doctor.
Physician looked at the skull and peeled back the hair and the scalp and probed around. And finally said, I see something stuck down in your skull, and it's kind of a shine to it, like a metallic object. I think you've been shot. You better go to the hospital and have the emergency room take a look at this.
Dennis didn't believe the race doctor, but
the thought of a bullet in my head just about brought up the hot dog.
Dennis went to Butterworth Hospital in Grand Rapids with his wife. He still figured he'd been hit by a rock or a brick. Turns out, the race doctor was right. Hospital x-rays confirmed that there was a bullet lodged in Dennis's skull.
I had visions of, you know, a huge army projectile kind of thing embedded in my brain matter as your mind races away with that first kind of news. But I was still just irritated that we hadn't broken 3 hours.
The bullet was a .22 caliber, and it was lodged in the thickest part of his skull, almost flattened against the top of his head, which seems lucky.
Well, I was either incredibly lucky or incredibly unlucky. I guess it's a flip of the coin, isn't it? In the wrong place at the wrong time, but I was certainly lucky they didn't do more damage or hit me in a soft spot, or that it didn't penetrate a little bit further.
The doctor needed to remove the bullet without damaging it, because it was now police evidence.
So he's trying to pull a slug that's embedded in the skull out with plastic-tipped forceps, and now he's got betadine, and it's pretty wet, and he couldn't get a good grip. And he finally got enough of a bite on the bullet and was able to dislodge it and pull it out of the skull.
It took 3 stitches to sew up the entrance wound. The police came and took the bullet and asked Dennis if he had any idea how he got shot. He didn't, and told them,
I know one thing for sure. The bullet was there when I finished the race, and it was not there when I started the race. So they said, okay, thank you, and released me.
He put on some dry clothes, left the hospital, and went to a nearby restaurant.
Well, I was a little late for our dinner with my fellow runners. They were all waiting at the restaurant for me, and they said, what happened? I explained it.
Dennis told his fellow runners about the bullet, and
we had a good laugh about it, and said, and basically shrugged it off as just something that happened, didn't pay much attention to it.
And Dennis was back running the next day. But a few days after the Grand Valley Marathon, he got a mysterious phone call. The man on the other end asked Dennis what he looked like. Dennis asked why the man wanted to know. And the man told Dennis,
well, I was in that race, and I would have been running about your pace. And I have some people that are unhappy with me and out to get me. I just wonder if you bought one intended for me. Now, that was about the scariest thing of this whole thing. Could it possibly have been a deliberate attempt aimed at someone else?
Dennis wanted some answers, so he asked for the police report. The police had examined the mark scratched into the bullet's surface, the way the bullet impacted Dennis's skull, and the way it flattened out on one side, and they determined that
the bullet seemed to have been fired from a poorly maintained gun, a damaged gun, a gun that had been perhaps equipped with a silencer. It did not ricochet off of anything. It just plopped into the head.
The police never figured out where the bullet was fired from, but the marathon passed through an area where it wasn't unusual to find hunters. And Dennis thought he was probably hit by a hunter's errant shot, though he'll never know for sure. News reports about the marathoner shot in the head quickly spread from Michigan across the country. And Dennis couldn't believe all the attention he got, from TV talk shows to radio stations to newspapers. He even appeared on the game show To Tell the Truth. Back in Boston, reporters approached some marathon officials and told them what had happened. The officials figured, without being shot in the head, Dennis would have easily broken 3 hours and qualified. They offered him a spot in the 1979 Boston Marathon. At the Hopkinton start, Dennis lined up wearing a singlet with the words Bullet Man across the front.
Nobody else had earned it, so I took it. I picked up the moniker Bullet Man for a little while, and I wore that to several races. Yeah, it was a bit of a joke on myself, I guess, but I try to take my training and running seriously, but not take myself too seriously.
Over the next four decades, he ran 21 marathons and six ultramarathons. And a DNF, or did not finish, was never an option.
Believe me, it's really hard to justify a DNF when you've finished with a bullet in your head. So after that race, I don't think I ever failed to finish because it was, what would I say? I got tired? What would I say? I got sore?
Being the bullet man pushed Dennis to train harder and run faster. His personal best in the marathon is 2 hours, 37 minutes.
Would I have gotten there without the bullet? It's quite likely I would not have.
Let me get this straight. Getting shot in the head made you a better marathoner.
Yes. Yes.
Post-bullet, Dennis became a patent lawyer and moved to Virginia. Almost 40 years later, he's retired and splits his time between training for his next big race and visiting his five grandchildren. As for the bullet, well...
Actually, it's in a little Ziploc bag, and it has taken several trips to school as show and tell for the kids.
Dennis is still surprised by the attention that followed the Grand Valley Marathon, but he admits...
It's not the kind of thing you read about all that often, is it?
Yeah, I'd be hard-pressed to find another marathoner shot in the head who finishes a marathon.
Yeah, well, it was only 16 miles with the bullet, so it wasn't the whole way.
That's typical Dennis. Now, sometimes he'll deny he's the bullet man. Or he'll try.
I think it'll be on my tombstone.
That story from WBUR's sports and society reporter, Shira Springer. By the way, Shira herself ran this year's Boston Marathon and finished strong, although she's such a competitor, I'm sure she's going to say she didn't finish in the time she wanted. But with this weather, Shira, you did great. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Imagine being an elite marathon runner, a former Boston Marathon winner, in fact. You're feeling great and finishing strong, even in today's challenging weather. But then you hit Boylston Street and you choose to stop and to slowly walk the last 600 yards to the finish line. Well, that's what Ambie Burfoot did today. Radio Boston's Jamie Bologna spoke to Burfoot a few days ago and joins us with more of his story. Hi there, Jamie.
Hi, Meghna.
So first of all, who is Ambie Burfoot?
Well, he's the editor-at-large of Runner's World magazine, but perhaps more relevant to this story, he's the 1968 winner of the Boston Marathon, so 50 years ago this year. He was in college back then, 21 years old, and he ran because his cross-country coach was a former winner himself. John J. Kelly won in 1957, and Ambie really looked up to him, and there had been no American winners of the Boston Marathon after John J. Kelly until Burfoot in 1968. So here's Ambie telling me a little bit about how he trained before that 1968 race.
I was a senior at Wesleyan University in Middletown, Connecticut. They tell me it was the age of sex, drugs, rock and roll on campus, but I didn't know anything about those things because I was training for the Boston Marathon.
And just to put a finer point on it, one of his classmates today, our very own David Boeri, remembers Ambie running an intense simulated marathon at the Wesleyan Fieldhouse not long before his actual win in a, quote, mind-numbing, torturous race of discipline and endurance. So that training really paid off because he won in 1968.
Now, Ambie Burfoot was just 21 years old then, right?
Yes, and he says he was too young to win in a number of ways. It was his third Boston overall. He came in 25th in his first Boston in 1965. He did better 2 years later in 1967. But in 68, his dad drives him to Hopkinton. And that year, there were about 1,000 runners. And he describes it as a great race to the middle, where he made a slight surge to break from the pack. And listen to what he says about what happened next.
I dropped every other runner except for one. And suddenly it was a mano battle, and it was terrifying to me. I didn't want to be just two of us. I wanted it to be a pack to the finish. We battled to the top of Heartbreak Hill. I tried desperately to drop him. I was unsuccessful. I thought about walking off the course at the top of Heartbreak Hill. I thought for sure I would lose at the end.
Wait, hang on a second, Jamie. Did sure. Ambie Burfoot just say that he thought about dropping out halfway through the course just because he wondered if he would come in second?
Yeah, and that sort of speaks to his inexperience and deeply competitive nature back then. I mean, just listen to how he describes himself in a WBUR Cognoscenti piece. He writes, quote, "I wanted to steal every possible second and race my personal best." And he goes on to say that "I ran fast and greedily." Hmm. And that's really what it was about for him, to be an elite runner on the level of his mentor. And Boston represented how they ranked among American marathoners. So I want to play another clip here of him telling me about them getting to the end, just the final two men, and then this is what happened to the other guy.
He cramped up on the downhills coming out, coming off of Boston College. So he cramped and I staggered, and I guess I won the battle of the two disabled runners the last 5 miles.
That's how he describes it. But not to put too fine a point on it, Ambie Burfoot won the Boston Marathon that year.
He won the Boston Marathon 50 years ago this year. And he's been running ever since, doing Boston off and on throughout the years. This year marks his 25th running of the Boston Marathon.
Wow. Okay. But now Ambie Burfoot's walking across the finish line. I mean, that's really interesting because that last mile is supposed to be all about celebration and the adrenaline rush of finishing this huge race. So why does he walk it now?
Well, so Ambie's a very introspective man. And if you think about it, running 26.2 miles is a very solitary act. You know, people run on teams and there are the massive crowds along the way. But in the end, each runner is, you know, in control of his or her own fate. In the end, they're responsible to only themselves. And Ambie tells me that for him, like so many others, that all changed in 2013, and that's the year of the Boston Marathon bombing. He was the oldest returning champion running that day. He had 1 mile to go when the police stopped the race.
I'm not proud to say that what was going through my mind was not the kindest of thoughts. We who were stopped had seen nothing of the finish. We had heard nothing. We only knew that we were being stopped a mile from the finish. And we had run 25 miles. We darn well knew we could go another mile. And yet we were being denied that wonderful final victorious mile. And particularly since I was a returning champion, and as you said, the oldest returning champion, I kind of thought I was a big stud that day. And so we were very angry. We were frustrated to be turned away. I had to walk back to my hotel. It took me fully 30 minutes before I had any idea of what had actually happened at the finish line.
And when you learned about what happened, what were you thinking?
I was thinking I was a small, petty, egotistic, worthless speck of a human being because I had been focused on myself at the 25-mile mark and did not realize the tragedy at the finish.
Wow. But Jamie, I mean, he can hardly be blamed. I mean, none of us really knew what was going on.
Right. I mean, it was a dark and confusing time, and nobody knew if there was going to be more bombings. And I know we hear this a lot, but eventually Ambie tells me that there emerged a sense of Boston strong.
48 hours after the bombing, we all wondered quite literally if this was the end of public road running, if it could be the end of the Boston Marathon as we knew it. And then we suddenly realized all together in some kind of silent unison that no, we were not going to let this be an end. We were going to make it a new beginning.
And Meghna, in the 5 years since the bombing, he's run each year with Team MR8, the Martin Richard Foundation. And here's Burfoot remembering the 2014 race, which was the first year after the bombing.
That race was a pure celebration every step of the way. We reclaimed the entire Boston Marathon course, 26 miles, 385 yards, and the people of Boston reclaimed us as their running heroes for that one special day that happens every year.
Well, so many people do indeed feel that way. But I have to say, it's something else to hear that from someone who's run the race as many times as Ambie Burfoot has. But I'm also curious. I mean, he's 71 now,
right?
71. So does age have anything to do with this new perspective, it seems, that he's got on the Boston Marathon?
Well, yes. I mean, like all of us, he's grown and evolved throughout the years. And Running a marathon at any age is a triumph, let alone at 71. And if he started running the marathon more than 50 years ago, quote, fast and greedily, that's all now changed.
Instead of greed, there really is a sense of gratitude that I feel as I approach the finish line. So thankful that I can still do this, that I'm healthy enough, the race is healthy enough, the community is so supportive. And I literally stop and walk the last several blocks of the marathon now because I want to appreciate every single moment of it. I give a little quiet, prayerful look upward. When I reach the place of the bomb that killed Martin Richard, I look left over at that and think of him and wish he could still be with us. And then I just cross the marathon at the marathon finish line at a very casual stroll, just overwhelmingly happy that I'm out there.
And so, Meghna, for Burfoot, running the Boston Marathon all these years, particularly since 2013, is a great fortune, and he feels very lucky to be able to do that.
Wow. Well, Ambie Burfoot won the Boston Marathon in 1968. He's run the race 25 times, and for the past 5 years, he's run it for the Martin Richard Foundation, and echoing, I think, a sense of gratitude that so many have there at the finish line. He talked with Radio Boston's Jamie Bologna. Jamie, thank you.
Thank you, Meghna.
Well, yesterday, Governor Charlie Baker and Boston Mayor Marty Walsh marked the fifth anniversary at the annual One Boston Day celebration. Here's Walsh, courtesy of WCVB, praising the strength of the bombing survivors and victims' families.
I thought about, personally, how fortunate I am to know all those families and their strength, as the governor said, and their resilience, and being there for all of us. The days after what happened 5 years ago, we were there for the families if they wanted us. And since that time, you've been there for us.
Roseanne Sedoya is one of those survivors, and Radio Boston's Cassandra Sunt talked with Roseanne recently about how she's viewing this five-year anniversary. Cassandra, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Meghna.
So you met with Roseanne. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yes. I met with Roseanne at Charlestown Spalding Rehabilitation Hospital last week. She received treatment there following the bombing. Now, in 2013, she was at the marathon with a group of friends to watch a friend of theirs finish the race. They were standing in front of the Forum restaurant when the second bomb exploded. That's the explosion that killed 8-year-old Martin Richard and Lingzi Liu. Roseanne was terribly wounded. Doctors had to remove her right leg above the knee. Meghna, she told me that it took her a while just to realize the extent of her injuries.
I don't think I realized all of the injuries that I had had, that I got through all of that. I remember when I was at Mass General and the burn doctor came in and said I didn't need a skin graft. I had, honestly, even though it was bandaged, my right hand, I had no idea that I had had burns. So at that point, it was kind of minute by minute. I know at another point that Dr. Crandall was monitoring my kidneys, and I really had no idea what was going on at that point either. So, you know, my goals have gone from almost trying to get instant gratification out of a goal to realizing that I need to take time and achieve those goals.
So, Cassandra, how's Roseanne then doing today?
She'll be the first person to tell you that the whole experience has been overwhelming, but that it gets easier every day. She's a bubbly person, just walking around with her at Spalding. I was joking with folks that she walks around like she's the mayor of Spalding, hugging everyone and just catching up.
But I imagine, though, that this is a really tough time of year for every survivor and every family member of the victims. But the race itself, though, that's special to Roseanne, right?
Yeah. She sounded wistful when she spoke about previous races before the bombing. She really loved it. She went every year, and she clearly is still fighting to get that feeling back.
Race day, it used to be my favorite day in the city. It was the day that I look forward to. It meant the beginning of spring, baseball season, leading into summer, all that good stuff. It's changed in the aspect of it's clearly not my favorite day anymore. I do work hard at making it, try to have it become that again. I don't think it will ever be that way. But now it's more of a memorial to me in the sense of what happened 5 years ago. And also to keep in mind that these crazy things aren't going to stop happening. And I think even though these bad things keep happening, good comes out of it so much more. So it's kind of just a remembrance for me of the good that's out there, and that eventually, hopefully, it will become, you know, a favorite day again.
Well, I imagine that part of recovering that hope has to do with recovering from her injuries. But you also spoke with one of Roseanne's doctors as well. And what did he have to say?
Yes. I also spoke with Dr. David Crandell. In addition to being Roseanne's doctor, he's the director of the amputee program at Spalding. In reflecting on the last 5 years, he said that the term Boston Strong took on a very personal meaning to him. Though he's treated a lot of amputees, it seemed to me that this group clearly left a mark on him. He told me that he actually ran the marathon in 2014 in order to, quote, reclaim the marathon and celebrate the hard work of his patients.
Literally, the actual training itself, which is long, and the race, which was a warmer day, was a bit of a struggle. But I do feel that that was a direct way to sort of reclaim the holiday and the race for its true meaning, which is to celebrate the community and to celebrate hard work and effort toward a goal.
Now, Cassandra, there's a really wonderful aspect to Roseanne's story, right? Because she recently got married, and her husband, Mike, was a firefighter working at the marathon on the day of the bombing.
Right, and she described to me that they've been a support system for one another, and that this holiday, this anniversary, is difficult for them, but in different ways.
My husband is one of my first responders. He is the person that helped put me onto the back of the police prisoner transport vehicle. And he just was there by my side right from the beginning and kept coming back and supporting and helping. And he hasn't really left since, which has been truly amazing. He's seen me at my worst. So I'll ask him if I'm having a bad hair day. And he's like, oh, I've seen a bad hair day. So, you know, he's good there for the support and everything. But this week is tough for both of us. You know, he was there that day. He tried to help out on a couple of the victims that he was unable to do anything for. And then he came to me. And so he's got memories of things that are terrible out there that, you know, as a firefighter, you're helping a little boy and you can't save someone who looks up to you. And he's supposed to be able to, you know, be that guy, that kid's hero. And that's tough.
She says it's hard for both of them, even though their injuries are different, but that Mike is trying to turn it around for the fifth anniversary by training to run the marathon this year.
Mike, my husband, is not a runner, so I'm very proud of him and happy that he's doing it. It is something that he's talked about over the last 5 years, but I think he was waiting for that moment, and that is this year. So very supportive of him, and I'm happy that he's doing it, and I'm hoping that this will help channel all of the bad stuff that he has in his brain that he remembers from that day.
Roseanne told me that she's been to the marathon every year since the bombing and will be there today to cheer on Mike.
You know, Cassandra, as we've learned over the past 5 years, the survivor community, and perhaps particularly those people who lost limbs, are incredibly supportive of one another, right?
That's right. Roseanne told me how the amputees will give each other all sorts of tips, like putting Velcro on the shoe that goes on the prosthetic to make sure it stays on properly, things like that people like you and me might not necessarily think of. But she also described to me how their network is growing and how she tries to mentor young people and new amputees in order to pay it forward, but also to stay healthy herself.
It just helps me physically and mentally to stay healthy, to show people that they can get back into their normal life again. And one of those examples is recently someone that I had mentored and met with about a year, year and a half ago, a young girl who lost her leg tragically in an accident is back out on the lacrosse field, and she just scored her first lacrosse goal. So it's very exciting that she was able to do that. And I feel, not that I feel like I'm responsible for it, but I feel like I have a little part in giving her the encouragement to keep doing what she was doing.
That's Roseanne Sedoya, one of the survivors of the 2013 Boston Marathon bombing, speaking with Radio Boston's Cassandra Sund. Cassandra, thanks so much.
My pleasure, Magna.
We want to give yet another shout out to Roseanne's husband, Mike Materia, the Boston firefighter who's running this year's marathon. You go, Mike. In addition, I want to give a shout out to former Radio Boston producer and current Modern Love producer, Amory Sievertson, who's out there on the course, and she's crossing over the Mass Pike route now and headed into Kenmore Square. Keep going, Amory. You're almost there, crushing it. And good job to every one of the runners of the Boston Marathon this year. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. The Cambridge Police Department says it will conduct an internal review following the controversial forceful arrest of a black Harvard University student over the weekend. Cambridge Police Commissioner Branville G. Bard says he continues to support the officers and that their actions should be judged, quote, in the context of a rapidly evolving situation.
The officers took the actions that they felt necessary at that time, but once again, I'm making no determinations as to prior to completing a complete and thorough investigation.
Well, on Friday night, officers confronted 21-year-old Salorm Ohin. He was naked and standing on a traffic medium on Massachusetts Avenue. In a video released by Cambridge Police, officers are seen tackling Ohin. At least one officer strikes him as he's being arrested, and bystanders repeatedly shout, "Don't hurt him." Joining me now with more is WBUR reporter Simone Rios. Hello there, Simone.
Hey, Meghna.
So fill us in on some of the details of what happened on Friday night. Police arrived at the scene at roughly 9 o'clock, and then what?
Yeah, so what we know from police reports and statements from officials in Cambridge is that a woman had called police to report a man who had thrown his clothing in her face. Several more calls apparently came in reporting a man standing naked, as you pointed out, on Mass Ave. The suspect is 21-year-old Salorm Ohin. Police say they were informed at the scene that Ohin had apparently taken some type of hallucinogenic substances. And while confronting Ohin, the officers say they observed him clenching his fists and started stepping towards an officer. That's when the police tackled him and eventually started punching him to get him to comply.
Interesting, because Cambridge Police did release a video of it, and I suppose there's going to be a lot of analysis of that video, because the officer who tackled Ohin in the video is seen as tackling him from behind. So it seems as if at least the Cambridge Police Department is admitting that force was used. I mean, what more did they say in today's press conference?
Well, you know, what they said I think makes a lot of sense, that force is the last course of action they want to use. In an ideal world, it wouldn't be used at all, but this is not an ideal world. They claim that it's hard to tell from watching the video, but they claim that Ohin was coming at them, you know, and they did what they had to do to protect themselves, and they point out to protect him as well. Mm. You know, I will point out that Cambridge police say they're standing by their officers, but as we heard in the intro, they're waiting for the results of an internal investigation before they make any official comments on, you know, whether it was right or wrong.
Right. Well, there is already substantial disagreement over what happened. I mean, members of the Harvard Black Law Students Association have released a statement regarding the incident. They say that some of their members witnessed the arrest on Friday night, and they claim that Cambridge police have released incorrect reports. Those are their words, incorrect reports of the incident. So what are some other members of the community in Cambridge saying?
Yeah, I mean, so there's probably, as is often the case in these types of situations, there's disagreement over some of the basic facts. By the way, you know, advocates of body cameras point out that that could, you know, the presence of body cameras could really help in a situation like this. Cambridge police do not have a body camera program. But the Black Students Association, they were very quick to condemn the use of force by the Cambridge PD. They said that they're not contextualizing this in sort of the broader national conversation around police violence. But in the same breath, they called this a, quote, brutal instance of police violence. They say that Ohin was tackled and pinned to the ground without provocation. Now, again, that differs greatly with the police account that Ohin came at police with clenched fists. The Black Law Students Association also questioned the involvement of police in the first place because Ohin was a student at Harvard. They say the university should have come to his aid prior to getting the Cambridge PD involved. By not doing so, they said the university put the student at risk of being killed by the police. I will say, Magda, other voices have been more moderate than that. Shagun Idowu is lead organizer for the Boston Police Camera Action Team.
One of the reasons that we righteously get upset is that officers, once they get to the scene, immediately before even understanding what's going on around them, they see a black body and they immediately attack. And from what I've seen in this particular case, it didn't happen that way.
Mm. Now, Simone, you mentioned that Ohin is a Harvard University student. Has the university itself made any kind of statement?
Yeah, they haven't said much. They sent us a brief statement saying that they're aware of the arrest of Ohin and they're gathering information on what happened. The officials from Harvard said in a statement that they're working to care for and support their students.
Okay. So just as a recap, the Cambridge Police Department is saying it will do an internal review. Meanwhile, Ohin has been charged with indecent exposure, resisting arrest, and assault, but no arraignment date as of yet. Why is that?
Yeah, so this is where it gets interesting, Meghna. These sound like a pretty daunting list of charges that he's facing, and they are, but he hasn't been arraigned, and we learned today from Cambridge Police Commissioner Branville Bard that part of the reason he hasn't been arraigned is because the department is evaluating his mental health situation. So it turns out that there's a possibility these charges could be dropped. They didn't say that explicitly, but Commissioner Bard sort of inferred to the fact that this is up in the air. He insists that Cambridge PD is doing what it can to be transparent and really have good relations with the community it serves.
Hmm. Well, that's WBUR's Simone Rios bringing us up to speed on the Cambridge Police Department's announcement of an internal review on the controversial use of force in the arrest of a Harvard University student on Friday night. Simone, thank you so very much.
Thanks very much, Meghna.
All right, we've got time left for one last check-in from the finish line of today's chilly Boston Marathon. And joining us again is WBUR's Alex Ashlock. Hello, Alex.
Good afternoon, Magna.
All right, so the major story of today, the weather. I mean, how much did it, the wind and the rain, slow runners down today?
The forecast on my phone says it's 47 degrees in Boston right now. I don't even think it's that warm. The wind was terrible today. It was just freezing cold out there. It made the times much slower than normal, which is totally understandable. The rain was just pelting people all along the course. In fact, the wheelchair racer Tatiana McFadden, who won the wheelchair race today, the women's wheelchair race, said at times she couldn't even see the course because of the rain and the wind blowing across. So it was just it still is not a good day to run 26 miles. If there really is ever a good day to run 26 miles.
Well, Alex, you're a runner. Of course there's good days to run 26 miles.
I mean, I've run in bad weather, but I don't think I've ever run in weather like this.
Well, nevertheless, Desiree Linden wins the women's race today, the elite women, the first American woman to win Boston since 1985. How big of a surprise is her victory?
It's not a surprise to me at all. She was fourth last year, second in 2011. She's just one of these athletes who sticks it out, even though she said she felt like dropping out today several times, in fact. But as she kept going, she kept passing people, and she realized at one point near the end of the race she was in third, maybe fourth, she wasn't sure, and she thought, well, I can't drop out now. I'm in the top five. So it's really good to see someone like this, an athlete like this who works so hard, get a reward like she got today. She first ran Boston in 2007.
Wow.
That's 11 years ago. So she hung in there and she got her reward today.
And the images of her crossing the finish line, soaked to the bone and splashing through puddles is just definitely one for the record books. Now tell us about the race on the men's side.
Japan's Yuki Kawauchi won the race today. He's the first Japanese runner to win the Boston Marathon since 1987, which happens to be the year he was born. It could be a big breakthrough for him. Japan has a great distance running tradition. He runs an incredible number of marathons. He ran something like 12 last year. But now he has this big major marathon victory. So it puts him on track maybe to run in the Olympics in 2020, which just happened to be in Tokyo.
Yeah. Well, we got about 45 seconds left to go here, Alex. I have to say the reason why so many of us love this race so much is that every year there's just this incredible story of heart and resilience and endurance, and today absolutely fulfills, it checks all of those boxes, doesn't it?
Completely. And I don't know how many people are total numbers are going to finish today, but if it's 25,000, 27,000, or 30,000, there's going to be that many stories of people who stuck it out today and finished the marathon here on Boylston Street under horrible conditions. Yeah.
Well, that's WBUR's Alex Ashlock reporting to us from the Boston Marathon, as he does every year. Alex, thank you so very much.
You're welcome, Magna.
And once again, congratulations to every single one of today's racers, whether you finished or not. Our hats are off to you. You guys are awesome. I'm Magna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.